Welcome to The Point. I'm Amy Vince, in for Mindy Todd. Later in the hour, Christina Clancy joins us. Her debut novel, Second Home, explores the fracturing of a family after an incident one summer in Wellfleet. But first, according to the CDC, approximately 32 million people in the United States have food allergies. Although it's more prevalent in children, 11% of people age 18 or older deal with food allergies throughout their lives. There aren't statistics on how many people have food sensitivity, perhaps because people don't recognize the symptoms. Today, we discuss the spectrum of food intolerance, everything from food allergies to food sensitivity, and the symptoms associated with each. With us is Dina Irwin. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and a registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods healing and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. Hello, Dina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's begin with defining the differences between food allergies and food sensitivity. Can you explain?
Yeah, so food allergies are something that could be very severe, have a very severe reaction to, including death. So that's food allergies are something that you really want to pay close attention to. And oftentimes, if someone has a food allergy, they have to avoid that food completely, including maybe not even smelling a food. Sometimes just the aroma of someone, you know, walking into a seafood restaurant who's allergic to seafood, smelling the food cooking, they could have a severe allergic reaction. So true food allergies are something that you really want to pay close attention to. A food sensitivity is something that would just make you not feel good, but you're not going to die from it. And a lot of people do have food sensitivities that they're not aware of.
Do we have any sense of how many? Are there any rough estimates of how many people suffer from food sensitivity?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. But in my practice, I see a lot of people who have different food sensitivities. And again, sometimes they're wondering, like, why they're not feeling good or, you know, why they're having certain issues. And, you know, when we identify the sensitivity and remove it, they feel great. They feel so much better.
So what are the most, let's go back to allergies for a moment. What are the most common foods that cause allergic reactions?
There are a handful of foods that are common. Milk is a big one, eggs, nuts, and peanuts is a huge one, sesame, seafood, and gluten is also a big one.
And as you were saying, people with those severe allergies can die. What happens in the body that can lead to death? What's going on?
It's an inflammatory response. So think about like swelling. So maybe like the airways are swelling up and you can't get enough oxygen in.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned peanuts before, and we know that peanut allergies have been on the rise in children in the U.S., and it's the leading cause of death for children with food allergies. Do we know why American children and also kids in the U.K., Canada, and Australia are more likely to have a peanut allergy than children in other parts of the world?
Yeah, it seems more prevalent in the West, and there are a lot of different theories. One of them could be that we're overly clean, that we're not, you know, getting germs from dirt and things like that, like we used to. You know, we used to. Well, when I was a kid, you know, I played in the dirt, and now we're focused on, you know, using antibacterial soaps and staying very clean and things like antibiotics. So that's one theory. The other theory, it could be a genetic component. It could be toxins in the environment, maybe some pesticides that we're eating, pollutants. So we're not really sure.
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint.
And I want people to keep washing their hands.
Yeah, that's right.
So, you know, keep washing your hands, but maybe go out and you know, dig in the dirt and plant a garden or go to the beach and build some sandcastles or something like that.
Right. Peanuts can show up in all kinds of food, even in foods you may not expect. And some people have such a severe allergy that the smallest trace, as you were mentioning, can cause trouble. Can we trust food labels when it comes to severe allergies?
I think so. The food labels are very clear. If something was made in a facility that you know, that also processes peanuts. You know, so I think the labels are pretty clear. I would be more concerned with foods that maybe someone else had prepared that you're not sure what the ingredients were, or if they used an ingredient that they thought was safe that wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, anybody who has children, as I do, knows that in schools they're very serious about this. In the cafeteria, there's a peanut-free table for children who have allergies to eat at, and we're no longer allowed to send in items that we've prepared at home. It has to be sealed in a box that has the ingredient label on it. So it's gotten pretty serious, which makes sense when you have so many kids who are allergic. Up until recently, there wasn't treatment for food allergies, but at least in the case of peanut allergy, some doctors are trying to help people build up antibodies. How does this work, and is it proving to be successful?
There's a number of different treatments that they're working on. One of them is like an immunotherapy treatment. So basically they're just giving people like tiny amounts of the allergen over time so that your body builds up a natural immune system to it. There's DNA therapies that people are working on. It's really, you know, I think science is going to get there. I don't think we're there yet, but...
I also, doing some reading about this yesterday, found out that earlier this year, the FDA approved the use of a medication for those with severe peanut allergies. Are you familiar with this medication?
Actually, I'm not, but I think it's so great that they're developing some treatments.
And you mentioned earlier that it could be that food allergies are hereditary. Is there evidence of that?
Yeah, it definitely could be a genetic component. So that's why, you know, if you have, you know, siblings, if one sibling was allergic to peanuts, you'd be very cautious with the rest of the family.
We're discussing food intolerance this hour, everything from food allergies to food sensitivity. Do you have a food allergy you grew out of, or has your body become less tolerant of certain foods as you age? Share your story. The number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626, or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tree nut allergies are also common, walnuts, pecans, pistachios. If someone's allergic to one, is it likely they're allergic to all tree nuts?
They could be, yep. And a lot of times people are allergic to more than one food itself. So, you know, you might have someone allergic to sesame, eggs, and peanuts. It's across the board.
It can be across the board. We have an email from Catherine. She says, my son, who is now in his 30s, had an allergy to mold as a child. In the last 4 weeks, he had to go to the emergency room several times due to an allergic reaction to some unknown substance. I've heard that when you reach your 30s, allergies can change or become more severe. Is that true? And I think she's talking more about not necessarily food allergies, so I'm not sure if you are equipped to answer that. But can your body change over time as you age, and can you develop allergies or lose allergies?
I know for food, yes. You can develop allergies and intolerances at any time over the course of your life. And a lot of times with food allergies, if you had them as a child, you do outgrow them as an adult.
Another common food that causes an allergic reaction is milk. Is there a difference between milk allergy and lactose intolerance?
Yeah, so it's with the allergies, it's the protein in the food that is getting through the gut barrier. So you're not digesting the protein. The protein goes through the gut into the bloodstream, and that causes the immune response and the allergy. So that protein that's in milk, the casein, sometimes that's what people are allergic to. On the other hand, the lactose, which is the sugar component of the milk, sometimes that's an intolerance. And I think that most of us are lactose intolerant. That's a big one. And, you know, sometimes you can tolerate a little bit, like, you know, say if you had a little a serving of ice cream on a hot summer evening and you tolerated that fine. But if you went and drank a couple of glasses of milk every day, you know, you wouldn't, you know, maybe you'd get gas and bloating and and you'd be uncomfortable.
So as I was just going to ask you, is that the symptom of lactose intolerance? Is it?
For most people, it's gas, bloating, diarrhea, constipation. It seems to be GI effects with the lactose intolerance.
Why do you say you think most of us are slightly lactose intolerant?
Just from what I've seen in my practice and in talking to people over the last 30 years, it seems like that's interesting. We should look up the exact percentage, but it seems like it's a lot of us. And that's one of the foods that people don't realize that they're intolerant to, and that they have a lot of digestive complaints. And when they realize it's the lactose intolerance, they feel so much better.
And is it, when we talk about lactose, is that present in, I'm going to assume yes, but in cheese and yogurt, in anything that's made with dairy? Butter?
Anything that's made with dairy. So it's in smaller amounts. Lactose would be in smaller amounts in an aged cheese, like a cheddar cheese is a much smaller amount. If you're putting a little half and half in your coffee, it's mostly fat. There's not as much lactose in it. But it's in all dairy. And it's interesting, though, some people tolerate dairy from other animals besides cows. So they'll tolerate like sheep, like maybe some feta made out of sheep or some goat cheese, but they won't tolerate it if it's from a cow. And the yogurt is interesting because it's a fermented food. A lot of people tolerate the lactose that's in yogurt because it's been kind of pre-digested. It's been fermented.
And how about if it's in baked goods? Does that somehow lessen the impact?
It seems to, I think, because it's like a smaller amount. If you had like some buttermilk in a pancake or something, it's not a huge amount, but if someone had an allergy to the casein that's in the milk, then you would want to avoid that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it gets tricky.
Wheat is another common allergen, and then there's celiac disease. Do these two food intolerances present differently?
So celiac disease is definitely a gluten induced disease. And someone who is diagnosed with celiac disease, the treatment is a gluten-free diet, and it's totally gluten-free. So gluten is one of the components that's in wheat. And gluten's also in barley as well. But if you're wheat intolerant, it might not even be the gluten component that's in the wheat that's bothering you. It could be the fructans or some of the other components that are in the wheat. It might not even be the gluten.
So how do you tell the difference? So how do you diagnose celiac, and then how do you diagnose intolerance to wheat? Or sensitivity to wheat?
Yeah, good question. So gluten would, celiac disease would be diagnosed by a physician. They could do a blood test, test for antibodies in your blood. They could do a biopsy if they were doing like a colonoscopy. So they could test for that. A gluten intolerance or a wheat intolerance, it's more trial and error. Or you could do an elimination diet to figure that out. There are some tests that you can have done for food sensitivities, which might help to identify that.
Okay.
I tend to believe that our bodies know what what's good for us and what's not. And oftentimes we just don't pay attention to it. And I think just being mindful and listening to what our bodies are telling us, sometimes that can be a huge help.
Makes a difference. Well, let's talk about food sensitivities and sort of how we figure out which foods might be causing us distress after a short break. But Dan has given us a little update about lactose intolerance. Approximately 65% of the human population has reduced ability to digest lactose after infancy. Lactose intolerance in adulthood is most prevalent in people of East Asian descent, with 70 to 100% of people affected in these communities. And that's from the U.S. U.S. National Library of Medicine. Thank you, Dan, for getting that for us. You're listening to The Point. I'm Amy Vincent from Mindy Todd. We're discussing food intolerance, sensitivity, and food allergies this hour. With us is Dina Irwin, integrative nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod. Do you have a food sensitivity? How did you pinpoint which food or foods bother you? Share your story. The number is 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can send an email to thepoint@capeandislands.org. So let's talk about food sensitivities, Dina. Are there certain foods that you found over the years that are associated with food sensitivity?
Yeah, there's something called FODMAPs, which is an acronym for words that I probably can't pronounce. But basically, they're just these undigestible carbohydrates that are in certain foods, and a lot of people have food intolerances to those. So in particular, like lactose is a FODMAP that we were talking about. Wheat is one of them. Onions and garlic are big ones, and they're such good, healthy foods. And, you know, we're usually encouraging people to eat a lot of onions and garlics, but some people don't tolerate them at all. Apples could be another big one. Sometimes these are really good, healthy foods, and some people just don't tolerate them.
Well, that's so interesting because they're also from really different food groups. So yeah, that's tricky.
It is tricky. It is tricky. And sometimes it's because we have leaky guts. And when we can heal our gut, then we can introduce those foods back in and we tolerate them.
What is leaky gut?
Leaky gut. So that's where, our gut is huge. Like our small intestine, I think, is like 22 feet. Like this is a huge amount of gut surface area. And our gut should be nice and smooth together. So if you think about a bowl, you know, like a mixing bowl, nice and together. If you think about a colander, something that you drain your pasta in has holes in it. So we want our gut to be more like have the surface of the bowl and less like the surface of a colander. So if you have leaky gut, you have more like a colander surface, and certain things like some of the proteins that are in food sneak through the gut, like those little holes in the colander, and they get into the bloodstream in the body where they can wreak havoc.
And why would you have a colander instead of a bowl?
Is that right? So that's a good question. It could be a number of those environmental factors that we were talking about earlier. It could be, from toxins and pesticides. It could be from antibiotics. It could be from not having the right balance of bacteria in our guts, the gut microbiome. There's like 5 pounds of bacteria that live in our gut. This is a lot. Mm-hmm. And some of them are good bacteria that we need to have more of, and we don't have enough of those. Those bacteria are our friends. It's a symbiotic relationship. Some of them are producing nutrients, short-chain fatty acids, that are really important to our health and our gut health. Mm-hmm. It's kind of fascinating. Well, I guess if you're a nutrition geek. Like
Well, we have a call. Shelley is calling from West Barnstable. Hello, Shelley.
Hello.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm
Thanks
well.
For having me.
What would you like to share?
Well, I wanted to find out, because I've had some issues with bloating and gas, and I've talked to my gastroenterologist. I've had, I've been on the FODMAP diet, and I've had an endoscopy, and celiac has been ruled out, but it seems like everything I eat makes me bloated, and I'm just sort of at a loss at this point, and I'm just wondering if a food tolerance test would be something that I should do next, or I'm just kind of at a loss for where I could go from here.
I'm so sorry that you're going through all that. You could go back and talk to your physician and see if they want to also test you for small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, if that hasn't been done, or sometimes H. pylori, which
hasn't been done. Yeah,
make sure those were done, just to rule that out. But definitely some food intolerance, like some LEAP testing, for food intolerances might be helpful, or even keeping some food journals so that you can try to identify maybe different foods that are triggering it. It's because sometimes it's not what you ate right away, but what you ate 2 or 3 days before. So sometimes by journaling, you can kind of keep track of what's been going on.
Okay. Good luck, Shelley.
Good luck. I know everyone is so different and individual. It's hard to say.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk a little bit about keeping a food diary and journaling. How do you recommend people set that up? And I know there are even some apps that you can use to do it if you want to do it on a smart device. What do you recommend to get people started?
I know there are some great apps, and I'm not a big app person, so I always have to have my kids help me with my phone. So I tend to do it by hand, and I developed a food journal form that I'd be happy to share with anybody. And it's just keeping track of what you're eating and any symptoms that you have. And by symptoms, it could be something like the gastrointestinal symptoms that we talked about, like gas, bloating. It could be a skin rash. Did you get eczema? Did you get hives? It could be a headache. It could be asthma. So there are a lot of different symptoms that people experience from food sensitivities. And then I also encourage people to keep track of their stress levels, too, and what was going on emotionally. Because there's a lot. Sometimes it's not actually what we eat, but how we eat. Because there's a brain that lives in our gut. And if we're anxious or stressed out, sometimes it's the stress piece of it and not the food.
So if we're trying, we're someone like Shelley, we're having these issues and we want to start doing the food journaling, keeping track of what we're eating, how we're feeling. Do you suggest that we minimize the variety of foods that we eat, or should we just eat normally, or how do we start?
I would start by just eating normally and seeing, for a week or two and seeing if you can identify any triggers from that. And then after that, there are two options. So one of them is an elimination diet, which is really strict. And it's only a very, very temporary way of eating because it's very restrictive and very difficult to do. So I usually don't encourage that. I usually suggest that people just eliminate like maybe one thing at a time from their diet and see how they are feeling. It's a much easier approach. So, maybe eliminate dairy for a couple of weeks. Just start with one particular food group at a time. It seems like a much more achievable way to do it.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, there are some food sensitivity tests on the market. Some people swear by them while others claim there isn't much evidence they're accurate. What are your thoughts on the value of food sensitivity tests?
I think the LEAP testing is very accurate. It's something that it's not routinely done by physicians, but there is, you could Google it and see who's doing LEAP testing in the area. That would be the one that I would recommend.
And when you say LEAP testing, is it a blood test? Is it, how do they test you?
Okay, so that's a really good question that I actually do not know the answer to, but we could find that out.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll do a quick Google. On that.
I know. I can see him typing away. We have an email that, from Trisha who writes, I have a serious allergy to beef. This is an allergy brought on by a tick bite so that one cannot break down the sugars found in the fat in beef. The allergic reaction is not sudden, but rather hours after I ingest beef. I get anything from major hives to an anaphylactic reaction. One can Google alpha-gal for more information. More and more people are getting diagnosed with the alpha-gal syndrome from a southern tick, and I think that's from the Lone Star tick bite. which, oh, sounds miserable. I'm sorry to hear that, Tricia.
Yeah, I know.
We also have an email from Patty who writes, I knew I was lactose intolerant from an early age. I hated to eat ice cream despite the rest of the family loving it. I hated it because of the stomach pain, but I discovered a gluten sensitivity after I started eating the paleo way and realized how much better I felt with both no dairy and no processed breads. Eating with friends and family can be interesting. Some people don't believe me and others want to know more because they recognize the symptoms in themselves. Feeling good when I eliminate these foods is my evidence for the people who do not believe me. Thanks for your email, Patty. And I think that's really important to talk about because I, you know, when you're thinking about keeping track of your food and how you feel and then having to give up something that you might really like ice cream or bread, if you focus on how good you might feel if you do that instead of what you're giving up, it might be a better mindset.
That is highly motivating, and I'm glad Patty's feeling better. But and I like to use an abundance model too in everything that I do. So thinking about all of the delicious foods that you can eat that will make your body feel really good. If you're not going to be eating ice cream, you know, there's delicious ice creams made out of coconut milk. I made a delicious fish chowder the other day that was actually made out of coconut milk. It was like corn, fish, and coconut chowder. Like it was so good. Even though, you know, I can't eat clam chowder anymore. Thinking about all these delicious foods that you can eat. So think about it more of as an abundance and not what's being restricted.
And do you find that as people age, they have more tendency to have food sensitivities, or is it people of all ages can develop them?
It's people of all ages, but I do find that women, especially as they get more towards menopause, can develop more food sensitivities. I don't know why. The other thing that we really didn't mention was like some of the processed foods. And I think if we can kind of focus on eating more real foods and less processed foods, I think sometimes there's just a lot of chemicals and additives and preservatives and things in the processed foods that just don't make us feel good or that can contribute to some of the leaky gut.
And especially if you're trying to keep a food diary, it would make a lot more sense to be eating things that you've prepared yourself instead of having to read through a label and keep track of all the different things that could be in those foods.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Are there, you had talked about the FODMAP, the FODMAPs, that the carbohydrates. I'd like to go back to that a little bit because I wonder if there are certain properties associated with foods that could cause a sensitivity. For example, you know, maybe people can't tolerate fermented foods or legumes. Are there groups of foods that tend to have similar properties that cause trouble?
Yes, there are. So FODMAP, so each of those letters stand for specific group of foods, and like you said, like legumes would be in one of those groups. And again, sometimes people can tolerate them in small amounts, so a little bit of hummus or some chickpeas on the salad they'll tolerate, but if they ate like a big huge bowl of chickpeas, then they wouldn't tolerate it at all. And sometimes it's what you ate over a couple of days. So maybe you had chickpeas 3 days in a row, and then on the fourth day you develop symptoms.
And I guess that's just another argument for really trying to vary your diet as much as possible, because maybe you'd be feeling better if you're just eating small amounts of different kinds of food instead of all of the same food.
Oh, yeah, and there's so many delicious, healthy foods to eat. So definitely, I think sometimes we get stuck in a rut eating the same thing every day, and a variety is definitely good.
A while back, we talked about sugar addiction on the show, and many people who have eliminated sugar from their diet said that after time, they stop craving it. So if you're, you know, setting down this road of wanting to eliminate maybe lactose or wheat or something, you might be so focused on it and you might be kind of craving it. Is there evidence that those cravings do disappear over time? Do our bodies kind of let that go?
I think so. Because again, our maybe it's just that that motivation piece that we were talking about is just because we feel so much better, so that we don't want those foods anymore because of, you know, we're feeling so much better not eating them. I do think that cravings lessen over time. And I think, too, just, you know, like we talked about the abundance and just finding all of these delicious things that we can include eating so we have other options. And variety, like adding all different flavors. You know, sometimes just adding, you know, I think there's like 6 different flavors that we taste, like, you know, the bitter, sweet, salty, astringent, and I think I'm missing a couple. And incorporating all those different flavors together in a meal can help with cravings as well. So, you know, kind of getting hit with the whole flavor bundle.
Right, which, makes me think, you know, it does take effort to plan a meal. You'll find the recipe, first of all, having the ingredients that you can tolerate or you can eat, and then chopping and prepping. And are there any resources that you recommend for people, especially people with food intolerance or food sensitivity, that would be a good place to start to find some of these recipes and ways to prepare foods?
Yeah, there are a lot of different meal planning resources that are out there, and I think I was way ahead of my time because I actually wrote a cookbook like 30 years ago, it's out of print. But it was on planning your meal for the week and doing your grocery shopping once a week and making your meals for the week and meal prepping. And there's so many different meal prepping ideas, books and websites out there that tailor to specific food preferences and food intolerances as well. But I think, you know, just keep it fun and simple and focus on the foods that taste good, that are naturally, you know, if gluten is your intolerance, think about foods that are naturally gluten-free that you could have, you know, like potatoes. You could stick a potato in the microwave and bake a potato. Mm-hmm. There's quinoa. There's, you know, there's all kinds of delicious options. I wouldn't go out and necessarily buy, like, all of these specific gluten-free foods because some of them are highly processed and don't taste that good and they're expensive.
Right. I think that's true. I think, you know, we want to have, we want to have the lasagna or the something that we're used to having. And so we try to find that substitute when it just doesn't taste as good as what we're used to. So maybe you're right. Maybe it means just branching out and stepping out of what we normally eat and trying something new that could be even more delicious.
Exactly. And condiments are a great way to add that flavor punch to what you're eating. So even like if you bake the potato that we talked about, if you had some pesto, whether you made it yourself or you bought it from it comes in a jar, and you put some pesto on your baked potato, like that's going to make it so delicious. Mm-hmm. So there's like easy ways that you can add different punches of flavor.
And I feel like this is a great time of year if you're thinking about starting a new diet, because in this time of year, we can get wonderful fresh produce and fruits, and it's there's an abundance right now. So maybe now is a good time to think about making some changes to your diet. Dan did, again, a little research for us for the LEAP testing. That stands for Lifestyle Eating and Performance. It's a test that combines the mediator release test to produce a specific anti-inflammatory diet designed to lower your inflammation, and by doing so, reduce or eliminate your symptoms. And that's kind of what you were saying, is it's a lot of these foods cause the inflammation, which causes us feeling uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely. And there are so many, everyone is so unique and individual and different. So sometimes it's hard to pinpoint it. It could be nightshade vegetables in a person, you know, things like eggplants, tomatoes and potatoes that they don't tolerate. And it's like, again, those are very good healthy foods that I don't want people to go out and start eliminating all these foods. But that would be like, you know, something that a LEAP test could help identify, like some of these smaller intolerances that we wouldn't normally think about.
Are there, just going back to additives to foods, are there common additives that people have a sensitivity to that might not even be chemicals, but could just be preservatives or other enhancers?
So, you know, when you think about things like MSG and some people, things like some of the colors, like the art, well, like I said, with the artist, you know, the artificial colors, the people don't tolerate very well. There's a lot of sugar sometimes hidden in foods that people don't realize that they're getting, and that's causing a lot of inflammation too in the body. It's not necessarily a food intolerance, but it can make people not feel good.
Because of the inflammation, yeah.
Yeah.
We have an email from Eleanor in West Tisbury. She writes, on a Sunday walk in 1948 when I was five, my parents and I passed a familiar farm where we often talked to the cows. In a gentle way, Father explained the source of hamburger and how we can thank the cows for our food. I remember listening carefully, making the connection, and never eating meat again. While the reaction appears to be a physical allergy, it clearly began in the brain of a young child horrified at the thought of eating animals. That reaction continues to this day. Interesting programs. Thanks. Thanks for your for your email, Eleanor. When you have a food sensitivity, it can be difficult in social settings, especially when you have multiple sensitivities or if you're invited to someone's house. What's your advice on how to handle those situations?
Yeah, that can be challenging. I always offer to bring something. And plus, you know, I was taught never to go to someone's house empty-handed, and because you know I have a couple of food sensitivities myself, so I, you know, I will always bring like maybe some a potato salad that I know I can eat, or a big, you know, quinoa salad or something, so that I know that there's at least one thing there that I can have that's not going to upset me.
That's a great idea. Dina Irwin is a registered dietitian nutritionist at the Community Health Center of Cape Cod and a registered yoga teacher. She practices integrative nutrition using whole foods, healing, and offers holistic nutrition counseling and cooking lessons through her business, Nourish. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Dina.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.